Psych meds are rarely as straightforward as their FDA indications suggest. And today we look at medications that can both cause and treat depression, OCD, and cognitive problems. Welcome to the Carlite Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor and the author of the new textbook, Prescribing Psychotropics.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue.
If there's one thing we learned in 2021, it was that psychiatric medications don't always behave the way we expect them to. That's what stands out as we look back on the 50-odd podcasts of the past year, starting with antidepressants. The name implies that these medications wash away depression, much like soap washes away oil and dirt. But the brain is more complex than that. And our February podcast detailed 7 situations where depression might actually worsen on antidepressants. We're going to start there. But first, a preview of the CME questions for this podcast.
Which hypnotic has evidence to improve depression and generalized anxiety disorder beyond its sleep benefits? A. Esopiclone. B. Melatonin. C. Zolpidem. Or D. Lemborexant.
Our first pharmacologic paradox is when antidepressants can cause depression. Most commonly, this happens in bipolar depression, and it's there that antidepressants are well known to cause mania. But, you know, mania on antidepressants is actually kind of rare to see in clinical practice. What's more likely is that antidepressants will cause mixed states and rapid cycling. When they trigger a mixed state, the patient is likely to say that it just made their depression worse, because mixed states are a more severe form of depression, with higher levels of anxiety, distress, and suicidality. When antidepressants trigger rapid cycling, the patient may not notice at all, because the increase in frequency of depressions that they experience with rapid cycling is usually gradual, steadily building over about 6 months or a year. That kind of frequency change is hard to pick up on without a mood chart. You also have to look out for antidepressant worsening of mood in patients who don't have full bipolar disorder, but have bipolar features, such as depression with mixed features, or patients who have hypomanias that last less than the cutoff of 4 days. There's a lot of epidemiologic research on these kinds of patients, and it shows that they can also get a worse mood on antidepressants, although they aren't as likely to get that as those who have full bipolar disorder.
But just because a patient's mood gets worse on an antidepressant, it doesn't mean they have bipolar disorder. Patients under age 25, those with borderline personality disorder, and those who are sensitive to anxiety or side effects like akathisia. All of these patients are more likely to feel worse on an antidepressant than average. But these are just risk factors for worsening. All of these patients can also improve on antidepressants as well. Turning to stimulants, you would think that things are more straightforward, but not so fast. In January, we looked at how psychiatric medications affect chess playing skills, and in particular, a study from 2017 called Methylphenidate, Modafinil, and Caffeine for Cognitive Enhancement in Chess. A double-blind, randomized, controlled trial. The study randomized 39 competitive chess players to play time chess against a computer after taking a placebo or one of those 3 stimulants. To our surprise, the players actually did worse on modafinil and methylphenidate. And the reason is revealing. The stimulants made them overthink their moves too much, and all that second-guessing caused them to run out of time.
In our online issue this year, we looked at how stimulants affected creativity and arrived at a similar conclusion. While the research was not definitive, there was a signal that stimulants might dampen creative thinking in some patients. So when a patient feels robotic, self-conscious, or lacking in humor and spontaneity on a stimulant, you might consider lowering the dose. We also reported on a study that looked at whether stimulants improve cognition in healthy subjects who do not have ADHD. That study found that they did improve performance on cognitive testing a little, but with a cost. Cognitive performance was actually worse the next day, presumably because the people didn't sleep as well after taking the stimulant. Overall, this research made us question the idea of a true cognitive enhancer. Seems like most drugs that are touted that way, including stimulants and the anti-dementia medications as well, seem to help some aspects of cognition while harming others.
One class of medications that has gone through a major reputation overhaul in the past two decades is the antipsychotics, particularly in mood disorders. Before 2000, the general consensus was that these medications treated mania quickly, but could cause depression long term. In the years since, so many of these drugs have earned FDA approval in bipolar and unipolar depression that people are starting to look on them as having inherent antidepressant qualities. In October, we launched a three-part series that took a deep dive into this question, and here are a few of the highlights. 1. None of the older first-generation antipsychotics prevent depression, and some of them may actually cause it. 2. Among the newer, atypical antipsychotics, only one of them has robust evidence to prevent depression in bipolar disorder. Quetiapine, Seroquel. One of them, paliperidone, Invega, actually increase the risk of depression over the long term.
A lot of that came from a recent meta-analysis, which only found that robust evidence for long-term prevention of depression with quetiapine. We mentioned that possibly esanapine, Safris, could fit the bill as well. But it's a surprise that many of these, even if they have good evidence for the short-term treatment, don't have so much for long-term prevention. The atypical antipsychotics certainly don't have anything like a class effect in depression. But what about mania? They may not always work as expected in mania either. We discovered that only half of them have evidence to treat acute mania, and those are also the same ones that are FDA approved in bipolar mania: aripiprazole, Abilify, esanapine, Safris, cariprazine, Vraylar, olanzapine, Zyprexa, quetiapine, Seroquel, risperidone, Risperdal, and ziprasidone, Geodon, are the ones that work in acute mania. And we can't assume that the others work but simply haven't been put through the test. This year, brexpiprazole, Rexulti, failed to treat mania in several large trials, and paliperidone, Invega, which we just mentioned had a tendency to bring on more depression in the long term, it also failed to work consistently in its bipolar mania trials, which is why neither of these drugs are approved.
So antipsychotics definitely do not have a class effect in depression, and it's starting to look like they don't have a class effect in mania either. Another place where we found paradoxical effects with antipsychotics is in OCD, where they can both cause and treat the symptoms. On the one hand, there are half a dozen controlled trials where antipsychotics treated OCD, usually as augmentation of SSRIs, but sometimes on their own, as in a study from 2021, where quetiapine treated OCD in euthymic bipolar patients at a dose of 325 milligrams per day. But on the other hand, antipsychotics can also cause OCD symptoms, particularly clozapine, where it's estimated that 1 in 10 patients develop OCD on the drug.
Finally, two of the podcasts that changed the way I think about psychiatric drugs came in the spring of 2021, on April 5th and April 28th. It's there that we looked at dozens of controlled trials that investigated whether benzodiazepines or the Z-hypnotics like Zolpidem Ambien can treat depression. We concluded that the benzos may have antidepressant effects beyond their effects in anxiety. particularly alprazolam, Xanax, and that one Z-hypnotic in particular can effectively augment other treatments in major depression and generalized anxiety disorder. That Z-hypnotic is esopetlon, Lunesta. The reason we speculated is that esopetlon is metabolized into desmethylzopetlon, a non-sedating compound with benzodiazepine-like effects that might reduce anxiety and possibly depression during the day. Now, this is all based on about 3 or 4 large randomized controlled trials, and they were all done in patients with insomnia and major depression or generalized anxiety. But what's important to note is that the sleep medicine had benefits beyond simply treating insomnia. So what I take away from this is that I might prefer esopetlon, Lunesta, for sleep in patients who also have anxiety and depression. And my preference here is not just because that one happens to have some good studies, but the others, particularly zolpidem ambien, were also tested, and they didn't seem to have this additional benefit. But wait a minute. If I'm suggesting that it might be through a benzodiazepine-like effect that esopetlon exerts its benefits in depression and anxiety, shouldn't I be worried about withdrawal symptoms if I use this drug long term? Well, some of the studies did withdraw the hypnotic after about a month or two of use, and they didn't notice any rebound anxiety or depression in withdrawing it, but that was just a brief trial. So we don't know the answer to how this thing plays out long term. But this series of podcasts, particularly the one on alprazolam, Xanax, did help me pick up on a withdrawal phenomenon in my own practice that I otherwise would have missed. Here it is, with a few details changed. I saw a woman who had been on high-dose alprazolam, Xanax, for panic disorder for many years. Now, high doses of alprazolam are sometimes necessary in panic disorder. Look closely at the PDR and you'll find that the drug is approved up to 10 milligrams a day for panic. And typically the doses are in the 2 to 5 milligram a day range with alprazolam for panic. But this woman had not had panic in many, many years, and she wanted to reduce her dose, which I encouraged, and we did. Now, my main concern in doing this, of course, is about rebound anxiety, but that's not what happened. As her daily dose dropped near the 2 milligram range, she called with severe depression. Now, it wasn't typical for this patient to get depressed, and there was no other explanation for the sudden episode. So, what we did, based on the podcast, we raised the alprazolam back up, and indeed, her depression resolved.
Paradoxical drug effects are not the only thing we learned in 2021. We also found out that topiramate works in PTSD, that ketamine is not the only glutamatergic drug that can lift treatment-resistant depression, that most of the commonly used genetic tests do little to guide psychiatric treatment, but that one test for the P-glycoprotein gene can make a meaningful difference in antidepressant dosing. And another set of tests can open up new avenues for autism. We learned that melatonin might have a synergistic effect with buspirone to treat depression, and we mourned the loss of two of our pioneering colleagues, Agapa Kiskel and Aaron Beck.
2021 also brought some new names to the podcast family. In the first half of the year, we launched a separate podcast stream that you can share with your patients, The Pocket Psychiatrist. It teaches behavioral skills for depression, insomnia, and cognitive problems. We welcomed a new journal to the Carlat family, The Hospital Psychiatry Report, edited by Victoria Hendricks from UCLA Medical School. And now, for the word of the day, note bloat.
Note bloat is when EMRs contain too many pages of non-essential information, much of it cut and pasted, and too much of it inaccurate. It contributes to burnout among professionals, and it's a safety problem for patients. Often the key details of their history are buried in the gibberish. Some blame EMRs and some blame the federal government, which created a reimbursement system in 1995, which ensures that clinicians get paid by the word. Well, we have good news. The feds have owned up to their mistake and created new guidelines that will trim these unseemly notes. But it's up to us to put that into practice. And next week, we'll show you how. If you've noticed a different sound to the podcast, that is the work of Zach Davis, who took over as our new audio editor last month. Along with Jeff Ives, Zach has helped us add CME credits to the podcast this year, and you can start earning them by clicking on the link in your podcast notes.